I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Joy Harjo served as the United States Poet Laureate for three terms, from 2019 to 2022. She's the first Native American poet to serve in this position, and her work often centers on the modern Native American experience, with over a dozen poetry collections, plus plays, nonfiction, children's books, and even a handful of saxophone albums. Her most recent book is titled Girl Warrior on Coming of Age, a collection of essays about growing up and learning life lessons throughout her multi-decade career. I recently spoke with Joy Harjo about Girl Warrior, and here's our conversation. So this new book is titled Girl Warrior. Can you give our listeners a short description of the collection?
Yes, this collection came about because I travel about quite a bit, and I'm always thrilled to meet young people who are starting their lives and are, you know, becoming artists, becoming scientists, it's why I call it coming of age. I just wanted to write stories and advice and insights to inspire them and help them along the way. And so that's what this book is several little stories of insights I've gathered or teachings that have been shared with me and so on to be helpful. And coming of age isn't just, you know, that age of adolescence, or there are many coming of age moments that happen in our lives at different ages.
In your essay titled Fury, you write about transitioning from physical fury to speaking fury in poetry. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, fury. I mean, every one of us harbors anger. You can be upset about something and maybe even anger, but it's energy, and what do you do with it? And that's something I think poetry taught me that. I didn't come to poetry necessarily because of fury, but it did become a useful tool to investigate with curiosity what this thing is, and to try to understand and find a way to use it as a tool for investigation and for rebuilding, or for understanding. And there was that moment where my son watched me in a fit of anger when he was young, and I watched me. I mean, you go back, it's important, as difficult and as humiliating as it can feel, is to go back and watch those moments, sometimes not your best moment, to understand it and to find a way to use it or to be with it so it doesn't shut part of you down. And so the fury, I realized that I had had it, you know, for some time. What ways can we express anger, and what happens when you tamp it down and you're not allowed to say, wait a minute, I really have strong feeling. You know, this is not right. There's righteous anger. And some of that, you know, it has validity. But then what are you going to do with it? How do you use it? And as we see now, you know, in our country, in the world, and in society, what do you do with it? Some people turn it against themselves, and with addiction and other things. Some people, you know, use violence against someone. Some people use violence in words. Some people use violence in trying to control other people. But you can use it to look at somebody like Gandhi. I think of Gloria Steinem using the anger of the injustice for women in society, or Wilma Mankiller too. Well, you use it to make change. And I think now there's a lot more I could have written. That's what always happens. I could go back and revise that with some of this of what I'm saying, but it does become a tool. So I felt it was important to address anger, and even to say, you know, it changed me to look at this moment where I saw my son's face, fearful. You know, here is his mother who loves him very much and is very, very maternal, and at the same time, very kind of independent, doing my thing. But for him to see me act in a way that was contrary to the way that I usually dealt with anger, which also wasn't the best way, like keeping it to myself. And so I found writing, and I do find writing a really useful tool to dealing with it. I mean, even writing it out to say, this is, man, and sometimes I'll write things out that I don't I don't want people to see, but it really helps. And then I can tear that up or delete it. In fact, I've got journals. I have a stack of journals over there I need to go through and send to my collections. But I go through and take out moments where I've talked about somebody in particular. I don't really want to hurt anybody. I just needed to express. And then when you go back and look at it, sometimes years later, it's like, why did that have so much control? But I think if you sit and write it out, or even before going to sleep, you can tell yourself, okay, please reveal or help me understand. And sometimes you're given things for that. That's the short answer.
You say, when your body is hungry, it searches for food. When your mind is hungry, it searches for art, literature, performance, and knowledge. And you write, when my spirit gets hungry, it goes to the mystery.
Yeah, that mystery. I was thinking about it. It goes to, what's beneath the beneath the beneath. I think that's why poetry or why music, and I've started painting again. And in that process of creation, that's where you go. It's mystery. I mean, where does it come from? You develop your tools, the tools for, I practice, scales, etc. I write, I read. I understand how somebody does something, but in the end, those are your tools. But when you sit there to create, what is it that comes through? It can be an amalgamation of that, but you think of all of the dreams, the thoughts, the actions, the history, and how it moves through you. I mean, that's a mystery of how and why all of that comes together in the way that it does. That's where I go to feed my spirit, is if I'm working on something, I research. But feeding your spirit too is everything from taking time to listen to a podcast, for instance, or an interview, looking at art, listening to stories, listening to poetry, dancing. I mean, for me, that's another way I feed my spirit. Children. I mean, everyone has their own way to refresh and nourish their soul. It's different for everyone, but I think what's common is the natural world. And everybody has places they like. Some people like winter, some people are, that's all part of it. And we need that. And we forget that in these days, because I think that's what's happening, is so many of us are drained. It drains you to watch TikTok. I mean, you might be getting cool stuff, and you can get hyped up, and there's a constant shift of images that keep you, it's an addiction. And yet, what replenishes, what do you walk away from feeling nourished by? And stories can be nourishing, or they can take from you. You go on Reels or TikTok, somebody's just stolen. They steal your time. And yet, when you've read an incredible book and watched sunset and sat out there and unhooked and sat with the family for an evening telling stories and learning things that you didn't know, visiting people and all of that, that's all feeding your spirit, and we all need that.
I noticed a recurring theme throughout a handful of the essays, and that's the importance of gratitude. How has gratitude served you, and why do you think it's so essential to being a girl warrior?
I think it makes connections. There's something about it that opens up possibilities, and it opens up relationship. I had an experience the other day where I had made one of our favorites, which is, I didn't grow up with this. There's a lot of stuff I make I didn't grow up with, but it's a clam sauce that I make with spaghetti. And I was sitting there by myself for a while finishing mine. And I was so overcome with gratitude. I was thanking the clams. I was thinking of the sun and the rain and just what it had taken, in a way that it was almost like I sat there and deconstructed with gratitude everything that had gotten that food there, and that it was nourishing me, and that I had this home and I could eat, and this bowl. And I think, why don't I remember this all the time? But what it does is it's about relationship. and about making relatives and about, even gratitude for the challenges. I mean, that's the big test, if you can give gratitude for the difficulties. And I'm having to learn to do that with some situations that I would never have imagined, personally, with family, and in this country. I have to stop and think, okay, what is there in this that I have to have gratitude for being able to see this complexity of story unfold in a way so that the story doesn't destroy me with grief.
I want to talk about grief because you warn readers that we will be broken with grief at least once in this life and maybe even 100 times over. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh man, I'm in the middle of learning grief in a way that I would never have imagined. The thing about grief is that it is a real thing, and you have to go through it. You cannot go around it. You might think you're going around it, but you cannot. But you just have to acknowledge it and then see what's there. I mean, that's the thing I think that has saved me is curiosity. We all have ways to help us move through and move through to understanding, and know that even as we understand, there's other levels of understanding, and there's some we will never understand. We just have to let it be for what it is. And we all have ways to do that. For me, I write, I'll play music, compose. Painting has been, I hadn't painted in 50 years, and I'm finding that that's become a big tool for dealing with grief. I'm not writing about grief. My first painting I just finished was very joyful, but I'm doing it, I'm moving through a particular grief with it. And finding something, picking something back up that I knew I didn't lose it, but I just knew it was there and I always wanted to pick it back up. But we all have our ways. Some people, they work on cars. I guess the thing with grief is about getting lost. That what it does is it makes you realize that you're lost for a while. There's a young poet who's went through recently losing his partner of many years. He lost her around the same time I lost my daughter. And sometimes it's just even more overwhelming than it was. And it's like, how do you? Sometimes it feels like you can't move through it, but you do, and you know you will. And that's a whole different understanding that you come to.
You mentioned that you will turn to music, and I'm very fascinated to learn more about how you learned to play the saxophone at age 40. In the essay titled Performing, you wrote that you loved what the saxophone added, as music can transport the words into a place beyond words, the place where the best poems live. Talk to me about deciding to play the saxophone.
Well, I came to poetry through music, through my mother's songwriting, and my parents were really good dancers, and we always had music in our home. And I love dance and I love music. So the writing came from song lyrics, and my mother loved poetry too, and I loved to read it. But music was always an important part of all of that. And the saxophone, is like a human voice, and I walked away. I don't know that I deliberately, but I did turn away from it. And around the time I was 14, because I used to sing, and I was an understudy and an operetta and all of that, and took clarinet a couple of years, played on the same reeds, I think. It was going in once a week to play, and I could play on piano just by ear, but my stepfather forbid me to sing. It was just his control thing. And my mother at that point, nobody sang or played music or anything when he was home. And then a band teacher wouldn't let girls play saxophone. So I just walked away from it. But it was always there. And then I moved to Denver at one point, in a place I said I would never live. And it wasn't my favorite place. But when I was there, I met some really good friends, a lot of musicians, and hung out in the jazz clubs. And that's where I thought, And a friend of mine, somebody had left a sax at her place for a while, and I picked it up, learned the G, had her write out the G blues scale, and she was a horn player. And then I bought a sax, a tenor actually, big old loud tenor, and started just bringing myself along. I was just kind of fooling around and then got into it. I went to Tucson, took a job there, and I went to have a photograph done for an article and met Keith Stoutenberg, and he was an alternative musician, even had a hit in Finland, but didn't, wasn't touring around, he couldn't. And that was the first time I played with anybody for a gig, and with this guy from the MC5, bass player. And so we did a few things, and then I moved to pull the band together in New Mexico. But for me, the horn was like, I don't know, it was just an extension. That's how I've had to see it. It's an extension of the poetry voice. And it hooked right in. I mean, that's what how poetry came to me. And so it continues. I've got a new album coming out from Folkways Records in March, produced by Esperanza Spalding, and I just bought a drum kit. I've been drumming every day, and that really helps with anxiety, speaking of ways to deal with anger or fury or grief, all of the above, and just write out on a doctor's pad, prescription, get a drum kit. But I'm learning. I mean, it's good because I'm learning stuff that I will be useful, but there's something in the whole thing that. So I continue to learn on horn too. So that's just part of it all. But yeah, I was almost 40, and the thing I've said is the spirit has no age. Because I would watch people give up, or some people get so focused. Well, I was six, I was the high school football champ or something, and they never get beyond that when there's so much life to live.
Do you have an ultimate hope for what readers will take away from this book?
I just hope that they're inspired or it's helpful, almost like a little manual, like if I get really down or I'm trying to find my way through something, and maybe I can open this up and read something that will be helpful. Just in the same way that others who have written have been helpful to me, or other, mentors. I've been blessed with many mentors, some of them in books and some of them real live human beings. And some of them are plants, some of them animals and the clouds too.
Well, the book is Girl Warrior on Coming of Age. Joy Harjo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Really appreciated this opportunity to visit.
Girl Warrior on Coming of Age by Joy Harjo was published by W.W. Norton. And now, book critic Suzanne Perez looks at a new memoir that explores why so many Americans have lost faith in what were once trusted institutions.
In her 2018 bestseller, Dope Sick, journalist Beth Macy took us into the epicenter of America's struggle with opioid addiction. In her new memoir, Paper Girl, she returns to the rural Midwest of her childhood, the town of Urbana, Ohio, to explore the social and political changes that have happened there, as in so many parts of our country. Macy explains that her hometown was hardly a utopia when she grew up there in the 1970s and 80s. Her family was poor and her dad was an alcoholic, but some things were reliable. Urbana's healthy economy nurtured a thriving middle class, and people believed in the power of a college degree to lift them out of poverty. Residents also were proud of the town's history as a stop on the Underground Railroad. But something happened over the past several decades, and when Macy began returning more regularly in 2020 to visit her ailing mother, she noticed Confederate flags flying and a wary populace that no longer trusted basic institutions like government, journalism, and public education. Paper Girl is part memoir, part reportage, part oral history, and the result is a comprehensive look at a microcosm of modern America. Macy grew up delivering the newspaper in Urbana, one of many local papers that no longer exist. She also grew up intent on a college education and believing that it was honorable and worthwhile. Now, she says, citing a 2022 poll, 37% of American voters agree with the statement that college makes you lose common sense. And 4 out of 5 Republicans believe that high school and college teachers are trying to teach liberal propaganda. Much of Paper Girl is depressing, if not totally shocking. Macy describes one former classmate who spouts QAnon conspiracies and then gets angry and even violent when questioned about their credibility. The epidemic of misinformation has transformed so many American towns. People take their truths from other people they trust. They don't use evidence to decide what's true, Macy writes. Paper Girl reflects the anger and discontent that have infiltrated our modern discourse. But Macy's courage and truth-telling arms readers with crucial information that, if only heeded by the so-called exhausted majority, could prompt radical change. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
Paper Girl by Beth Macy was published by Penguin Press. Joining us now is Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Books in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He's here to talk books with us. Welcome to Marginalia, Daniel.
Lovely to be here.
So what books would you like to talk about today?
This is such a wonderful opportunity. I'm going to mention Bug Hollow. It's been out for a little bit. Michelle Hunnevin is one of my favorite authors. She gets nice attention, but definitely needs a little hand-selling. It's a family story. I love that it's sort of a collection of stories that becomes a novel. She loves characters. She's one of only two of authors that I've read over the years that had my number one book of the year twice, a book called Jamesland and then a book called Search. This is kind of Joan Silber-esque, I guess, in that it the characters, a character talks and then another character talks. It starts with a family story with a twist, with one of the sons in the family going off on summer break and not coming home, and the mother getting nervous and trying to find him, and honestly leads to a terrible thing that changes the family dynamic forever. She's got a wonderful sense of humor. She's very smart. She's funny. She knows how to make you cry as well. Booksellers do a lot of test marketing, and I've had a lot of customers come back and tell me how much they love the book. So
very nice. Yeah, we spoke with her for Search.
Oh, God, I love her. She's also somebody who's just so, as a person, she just has a lot of wonderful energy.
Very good. What else do you have for us today?
I have lots of rules about reading. I like to take home stacks of galleys and read 25 pages and then rate the book so I can figure out which one I'm supposed to read more of. It goes 1 to 5, too detailed to give you more information. But I also like to read a middle grade book every month, and I like to read 2 nonfiction books, and I like to have a diverse variety of authors. But the nonfiction is really important to me. Publishers don't really believe that we move the needle in nonfiction that much, especially outside of the memoir area. I really like music books, very selective about them. When I was young, I was one of those people who listened to chart countdowns every week and a little over the top the way I am with everything. But every so often I find a book that I really like about music and creativity, and Night People by Mark Ronson, who is most well known as a producer, but in the 90s, he was attempting to DJ and build a DJ career. And the book is very nostalgic. It's very much about the New York nightlife scene, which seems to resonate with a lot of people. It's really a book about creativity because he's trying to find how he can be different as a DJ from other people. And I really love nostalgia for pre-internet times when you had to lug all the records to your gig. And like, if you wanted to find a song, you couldn't just go click on a search engine and find it. You actually had to dig around and go to meets and try to figure out what it was. And while I'm not a big hip hop person, a lot of the inspiration and the samples are from old R&B of the 80s and 90s. And I love that. I just found him so charming. I also find unassuming, you know, he is a celebrity, but he is just so modest, and he's also somebody who's just like surrounded by well-known people. So like, you know, he's in the same apartment building with Julian Lennon, and he's DJing with Jackson Brown's kid, and in between Jackson Brown's kid's modeling gigs and drug deals. Anyway, I really love that too.
Very nice. Do you have anything else for us?
I can keep going. I really loved The Listeners by Maggie Stiefvater, which came out earlier this year, and I am not a YA reader. Middle grade, yes, YA, no. But one of my booksellers convinced me to read this, the first novel, and I loved it. It's a historical fiction set during World War II. I would say more period fiction because it's not real people, but it's about a West Virginia resort, which is absolutely not the Greenbrier because they say that it's not the Greenbrier, where they would, they kicked all the guests out and put in Axis diplomats and their staff. And this young woman who is a local, she doesn't have a lot of money. She is the manager and she has to control the owners and the CIA agents and all the people staying there. It's got a thriller element. It's got a little speculative element, which will please the Maggie Stiefvater because of course it's West Virginia and the springs have magical properties a little bit. It's soft. And on top of that, I felt like it's kind of actually somebody who read A Gentleman in Moscow would really love it.
Okay.
So, or might really love it because it's got a similar sort of feel in terms of the hotel and a little of the momentum.
Okay. Very nice. I know you have more on your stack.
Oh, I do. I don't know if people have read. This is also from earlier, 33 Plasbergmann. It's one of my favorite books of the year by Alice Austin. She's a first novelist, but she's written documentaries and it's about a apartment building in Brussels. So it's World War II, period fiction, a popular war for fiction, and all the inhabitants of the apartment building and how they react when the Jewish family in the building disappears one day. You're following different characters. She's an American writer, but it reminded me a lot of British writers, such as books like Still Life and Whalebone Theater. Both had very strong backlist for us. And so I'm hoping that this continues to sell really well. I thought it's wonderful. It's obviously got movie potential too.
You've mentioned something twice now. You mentioned period fiction instead of historical fiction. Can you talk about that? Yeah, what's your rule?
Yes. Well, I don't know if everybody else is this, but my feeling is historical fiction should really be, if it's in genre, it should be a real event. And even if you change the names, it should be based on something that happened. Whereas I feel like period fiction uses the times but tells its own story. I wish people would be more clear about that because you want to know what it is going into it. I do read historical fiction. I've read a number of books recently that I've enjoyed. Secret Life of Julia Child, which came out last year. There's a new book on Dickie Chappelle. I really enjoyed this book, A Pair of Wings, that came into paperback recently by Carol Hobson. It is about Bessie Coleman, one of the first Black female pilots
right,
and
yeah.
The difficulties she had going to flight school, the difficulty she had getting planes. It's a really inspiring story. I thought she did a really great job, tons of research. I love the author's backstory as she became a pilot while doing the work on the book. But it cues very closely to Bessie Coleman's story. And it's very important for me on a historical fiction to have an afterword that tells you what the author made up and what's changed about it and what's actually happened. And I don't feel like you need that in period fiction.
Okay.
But I feel like if you're going to use some real people, tell me what's going on.
Okay. Well, we will include a list of all of these books at our website, kmuw.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Daniel.
Oh, my pleasure.
That is Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen, Luann Stevens, Suzanne Perez, and Carly Cooper. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.